Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy. Very good.
Welcome to Democracy Sausage Extra for this week. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute, and this podcast comes to you twice weekly with the support of the Crawford School of Public Policy. The PM, Scott Morrison, has unveiled a $270 billion defence boost, including missiles and other super expensive technology, as a burgeoning Cold War threatens to become a dangerous hot one at some point. Strangely, less thought and investment went into the preparedness for a pandemic, despite plenty of warnings that a superbug would wreak havoc and take lives and could happen at any time. That time, of course, is now. And yet, despite that mismanagement, governments across the country, including the national one, have gone up in public support, with premiers like Peter Gutwin and Mark McGowan registering 93% approval ratings, according to recent polls. I'm delighted to welcome to the barbecue area one of Australia's highest profile and most respected journalists and authors, the ABC's chief writer and all-round most versatile broadcaster, the one and only Annabelle Crabb. Welcome, Annabelle.
Hello. It's very nice to be with you. I'll be having a vegetarian democracy sausage, please.
That's the way, because I was a little bit intimidated about having someone like you at the hot plate because, I mean, someone who does cooking shows and is an expert
at
recipes, I've
seen this. A snag is very difficult to bugger up in my experience, Mark. But yes, I have noticed over the last decade or so that polling booths often do have a vegetarian option, which is not something that you would have seen a bit longer ago than that. So I'm often
in
a very good position. I also like the bake stall, but there you go.
So you don't go for the actual fully sort of traditional meat snag?
No, I do not. I haven't eaten meat since I was about 17. So I'm really out of the habit. So if they've got a bit of a halloumi in a roll, I'll go for that. Or a vegetarian snag, even though, I mean, I actually think vegetarian snags have about as much real meat in them as general snags. But, you know, I guess only a qualified lab technician to be able to establish the truth of that.
Well, look, as you know, I'm in the same boat as you. This may be a shock to some people given the name of this podcast, but I'm not eating the meat snag either.
I thought I might rumble you.
Well, you know, the other thing, I wasn't planning to do this, but the other thing that's interesting about the title of this podcast is that it does draw its name from the very tradition that you referenced a minute ago, the card table with the sausage sizzle going outside the polling booth,
yep,
which has become very much a staple around the country. But it also draws its name from that idea, you know, that old quote of Bismarck or whoever said it, that the voters didn't want to see. It was supposed to be, but I'm not sure about the derivation
of
it.
It's one of those ones that's tossed around a little bit, I think, but the majority support seems to be von Bismarck.
Yes. And the voters don't want to see how the sausage is made. They might be happy to eat it, but they don't really want to see the process. Well, we're all about the process here. Anyway, along those lines, I thought we'd start out just talking about how Scott Morrison is going. Obviously, he's riding high in the polls, as I said a minute ago, as most moderately competent governments are in this crisis. But is there a sense, and this is a feeling that I have about the way he is performing. Some people are going to reject this violently, but... Is there a sense that he's actually also doing something that really no prime minister has done since the late 90s when you think about it? He's learning on the job. We saw John Howard do that. He only scraped through the 98 election and had some pretty big reform, obviously. We're recording this on the 20th anniversary of the introduction of the GST, which was, the dominant political issue then. But Howard had time to learn on the job. He made it from one election to the next. No prime minister has actually done it since Howard. Here we are sitting at 2020 and no prime minister has actually been elected by the people and made it to the next election at all. And so they haven't really had time to grow or learn in the job.
2004 is the last time a prime minister won an election and then contested the next one.
Yeah, that's right. But what I'm saying is none since Howard. I'm saying that he learned on the job between 96, 98, 2001, say, and obviously developed as a prime minister. But the point is he had time to do so. Once we get to the Rudd era, Rudd doesn't make it, Gillard doesn't make it, Abbott doesn't make it, Turnbull doesn't make it, and now we're at Morrison, and it looks like he's going to make it, of course, because the rules have changed and, we can't really see it going the other way. But
I've always been of the view that first-term governments are usually completely rubbish. I mean, they're actually no good at governing, and it takes a while to learn. And, particularly if you've spent a long time in opposition. But if you have a look at Rudd in 2007, he won a significant campaign victory, but went into government with, I think, only two ministers who'd ever been even briefly in the Min Wing before. So that was, I think, Simon Crean and John Faulkner were the only two people that had ever served as ministers before. And if you look at the Rudd campaign of 2007, it was full of all this sort of, we're going to throw open the doors of democracy and let a little sunshine in, etc. All the sorts of things that you hear leaders saying when they haven't got any experience of just how grindingly frustrating a task governing as a Commonwealth government in this country can be. And I mean, Howard in his series of headland speeches before 1996 set out all sorts of broad ideological and strategic positions and then hit the ministerial wing and was immediately, had his tires shot out with all sorts of governance issues and travel rorts and everything that kind of can complicate your life as a new government. Now he had a huge enough margin in 1996 that he was able to hang on by the absolute skin of his teeth in 1998.
He lost the popular vote, didn't he? But he just won the seats.
Yeah, he did. But he had a big enough margin, that he was able narrowly to succeed. And I actually think, if you are comparing John Howard with Scott Morrison, Scott Morrison has a strategic advantage over 98-era Howard in that he didn't have a particularly ambitious agenda when he went to the people in May last year. He was graced, I suppose, with an opposition that was proposing to do a whole lot of stuff. He hadn't been prime minister for very long, and there had been this sort of jumbled and vicious assortment of internecine rivalries that infected his side before he went to the election in 2019. Essentially, what he went to the election promising was the tax cuts and not to do anything that Bill Shorten was promising to do. And obviously things started out very badly with the bushfires and the Prime Minister's really inept response to them, and things went south pretty quickly. But the point at which I think he did learn about how to respond to disaster and how to to lead people through it, I guess, became apparent pretty quickly in the early days of COVID-19. And I mean, here again, he benefited from his lack of ideological shingle in that, I mean, can you imagine Malcolm Turnbull deciding to form a national cabinet and let in all these Labor premiers who actually almost had the numbers on that group? I mean, I don't think he would have survived a day doing that. But it was something that Morrison, because of the strength of his unexpected victory, because of his lack of internal vicious opponents, he managed to do that, and it was something that really resonated with people more broadly, because we're so unused to seeing different sides of politics cooperate in the public interest that I think when we saw it happen in the context of genuine crisis, it was something that people really appreciated. And I think that that has probably bought him the ears of people who might otherwise have been really shut off to politics for quite some time.
Yeah, I think that's right. I certainly agree with you about him lacking an agenda to begin with. I mean, he didn't really expect to win, a bit like Trump didn't expect to win. Certainly Morrison's team was not expecting to win. All the polls showed that Labor was going to win. And he really ran on that platform of, you know, don't be Labor, don't go with Labor's huge suite of spending promises. There was also a kind of a subliminal message, which is don't be Abbott or Turnbull either. I mean, he was kind of the clean skin who wasn't either of those two old lions of the of the Liberal Party's division.
Loathed by most of both of them after the
that's right.
After the events of
that's right.
The latest leadership spill. So yeah, I mean, and there is, you know, some sort of comfort in being despised by both combatants. It sort of keeps things calm.
Well, it does, and it just wrestled itself to an utter standstill, the coalition on that, and suddenly there's Scott Morrison standing there talking about going to the footy and so forth. I guess we can talk about that
as well,
but. Yeah, that's the one. But look, I'm interested in this point you make about the bushfires, the juxtaposition of that and the handling of the COVID crisis, because certainly the way I've viewed it is that his kind of, in a sense, near death political experience, or his brush with political mortality after that miracle win, as he described it in 2019. It was made very clear to him, I think, by his Hawaii holiday and, the way he handled, delayed going down to the fire grounds and so forth. Just the absence of leadership. It was made very clear to him how not to do it. And he was blessed in a way, and I don't wish to suggest that anyone would want this, but he was blessed in a way by the sudden hoving into view of this other crisis, which was a genuine national and international crisis. And as you say, he then goes about, I think, trying to do it manifestly differently from the way he's done it on the bushfires. And you have the formation of the National Cabinet. You're right. I don't think Turnbull could have done it. But I think Morrison, being so good at kind of marketing, as people say as well, he also knew that the gesture itself ratcheted up the kind of urgency and focus and authority with which he needed to, proceed and get things done. And, so the announcement value of the National Cabinet was really strong. And we've, of course, seen him since very strongly aligned behind the medical experts for the most part, and also behind the states having their own jurisdictional responsibilities for a whole range of things, and he's sort of sought to project that as well. So it's been I mean by growing.
Yeah, I mean, it also gave him an opportunity to lead vigorously in an area that wasn't already just laid with the IEDs of previous leaders. There are heaps of areas of policy, I reckon, on both sides of politics too, that are so infected with the bad blood of the past that you can't even say anything sensible, in those areas without immediately kind of conjuring those ghouls. And I think that this is, new crisis, new challenge. And I mean, it is really instructive, I think, to look at the last few months and say, hey, look, this is a country that, unlike America, can come together, lay down its political weapons for a while in the face of a menacing and frightening enemy slash threat and make sensible decisions. I mean, and now we've been unable to do that on climate for 10 years. So it's a really interesting comparison in response to threat, I think.
Do you think it changes that climate question? There's been a lot of wishful thinking or hopeful kind of speculation about that.
No, I don't think it does. I do think, though, it probably gives, and this may contribute to Anthony Albanese's recent offer to find some sort of accord on climate. It gives, and I think this is useful, both sides of politics, a little taste of how much people like it when a compromise is reached and when people make concessions. Because, you know, I mean, that is one of the hard things about politics now is that even though when the Australian parliamentary system was devised, its principal purpose was for people who disagree to come together and work out, you know, a solution that annoys the least number of people. You know, I think one of the great difficulties that our democracy is going through is that we have weaponized conflict. We've, in a way, political disagreement has a value to the protagonists that is greater than the value of consensus. And that's a really bad place to be. And certainly climate is the leading area, I think, where it is worth more sometimes to protagonists to disagree loudly with each other than it is to reach a consensus that would be viewed as flawed by everybody for different reasons. But that is supposed to be what democracy is about, right? Like, you know, no one's ever completely happy, but you come up with something that is broadly acceptable to everybody.
Yeah, well, I think what people are embracing, as you say, is compromise, but it's also this notion of problem solving, which actually, when you get down to it, is what the whole business of government is about.
Of course.
Mm. It's about problem solving, and that has been a very strong focus of the COVID response. It's been a very strong absence in the climate response, really.
Yeah.
And it's so inflamed that we have the two sides not able to agree with each other or not even able to agree with their own former selves.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That happens.
But it's extraordinary.
I think beyond, you know, the issues of how do you maintain the health and safety in the COVID-19 era and whatever. I mean, like, beyond the specific problems occasioned by this pandemic, I do think that a genuine crisis that seizes the whole country and puts us all, you know, in the frame is an opportunity to do things differently. I think it is, I mean, ask any business operator that has evolved and changed and learned how to do new things differently over the course of this pandemic. I mean, I think we're a different country now from the way we were a few months back. And I mean, I'm a sort of demented optimist, but I do think that there is a real opportunity here for big decisions, good decisions to be made for this nation. And, you know, for a guy who really won the last election without a very big to-do list, I mean, the Prime Minister now has a massive to-do list and a huge opportunity, I think. And he's set himself a few dangerous rhetorical questions like, you know, well, how would we redraw our IR system? There's this energy review, you know, the technology investment roadmap, which is maturing alarmingly soon as well. So there's an energy element. There's what do we do about what was New Start? I mean, there are big decisions as to how this government is going to approach welfare when the JobKeeper, JobSeeker period comes to an end and there's still a lot of people needing support. And then, of course, there's the decision about the federal-state relations and tax reform. You've got a very, very ambitious New South Wales Treasurer, Dominic Perrottet, who's about to release his review of federal-state financial relations, which I think will be quite provocative. So there's all sorts of things that the Prime Minister could adopt as his signature reforms. I think he's aided by his lack of previously expressed ideological predilection on these issues. And I think he also is aided by the fact that we've learned that we can make change, and crisis is a good opportunity to make change.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Let's take a quick break there, and when we come back, take up that point about what he might be able to change.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
All right, welcome back. Now, we were talking before about, you know, this being a moment of potential change, this crisis. It struck me while you were talking, Annabelle, that many organisations, we see this written all over the economy, many organisations, companies are restructuring. They're having to do so. They're changing the way they work. They're thinking about what they're going to do as they come out of this. And virtually all of them say that in some way they're going to be different. The hard truth is, in many cases, they're going to be smaller, less travel, more working from home, all kinds of different different changes. Some companies, I guess, returning to tours a bit, you know, realizing that there are certain things that they've sort of built up over time that are no longer really they're not really part of their original core mission, and they perhaps won't be going back to. So there's so much happening, and the risk here is that we could have a government that doesn't make any changes. That wastes this opportunity. There's a lot of hope around at the moment, as you say. There's a lot of people talking, Dominic Perrottet and others talking tax reform. But we haven't seen much in the way of courage for reform from, you know, certainly from this government, and not much really in the last decade. So.
Sure. I mean, look, the old adage, of course, is that it's the first term where you need to really stamp out and lay out your reform agenda, because often it'll take you a huge amount of time to get it through the Senate. The Abbott government in 2014 handed down an absolute cracker of a budget that had lots of memorable restructuring in it, right? Like, but all of it ended up in the voodoo aisle of the Australian Senate. So, I mean, there have been attempts to do vast things.
You're right there. It wasn't exactly mandated, but it was certainly vast.
No, right. Well, I mean, that was the sort of sneak up and say boo version of reform. But I do think the incomplete first term of the Morrison government was probably just a sort of a bit of a seat warming exercise. No one was expecting Scott Morrison to be Prime Minister when he was, probably including Scott Morrison. So I think this is, you know, this term is the definitive one. If he's going to try and bite off a big reform like restructuring federal-state financial relations, maybe reforming the GST, maybe revisiting that idea of changing up income tax to give the states an opportunity to access that. I mean, the great imbalance of the federal-state financial relations in this country is immortal. Like, it's just various leaders have tried to have a crack at it, which is, you know, what the states do gets more and more expensive every year, but their tax base shrinks or becomes more kind of sclerotic and difficult. So they rely on support from the Commonwealth, and the process by which they get that is usually over time gets encrustulated by political difficulty. Now, if you could come up with an elegant solution for that long term, I think you would end up with a much more economically run federation. The question is, are you ever going to get a prime minister that's on sufficiently good terms with state and territory leaders to actually do that? And arguably, look, this guy is better placed than anyone, any federal leader that I can remember, because he's in a group of people who have been, as a national cabinet, meeting together for months and months, not in that kind of COAG way where they book a room in Canberra and everybody prances along with 100 press secretaries and, you know, advisors and bureaucrats, and it becomes this performative piece where everybody's looking to see which premier flounces out first or who denounces the federal government, you know, the most eloquently on their way either in or out. This is a much more personal format where they're all phoning in or zooming in or whatever from their own homes, from their own seats, from their own electorates. I mean, that actually has a more genuine federalist feel to it than the absolute, you know, farce that COAG had become. I mean, the last time COAG was really useful was probably actually in the GST era. I think we're ready for a redraw. And I think that extemporized model that formed over the COVID crisis unexpectedly has proven quite successful. The question is, you know, can it be turned to other more rusted on problems? It'll be just fascinating to see if it can be.
Yeah, well, Ken Henry, of course, the former Secretary of Treasury who famously did the Henry Tax Review, has made the point that if you're going to do it, the two times that it can be done, this is, significant tax reform, for example, is, when things are really booming and you can afford it, or when you have a crisis like this.
You're
screwed anyway. And what he's saying is that you can, when things are really booming, you can actually afford to buy the change. Now, it's something that I think people haven't properly grasped, this idea that there will be some significant losers from a tax change, for example, in broadening the base or increasing the rate or both of the GST. But if you're prepared to compensate the losers in that process, and you may even be prepared to go backwards fiscally for the first 2 or 3 years or whatever it might be in order to put in place proper structural reform. Now, this isn't a boom time like that, but it is a time when vast amount of borrowing is happening in order to do that restructuring. The goodwill is there, or at least it's potentially there.
If you have a look at the state taxes that are the worst, stamp duty on property and payroll tax. Well, both of those, I mean, they're tanking because of the decline in exchange of properties. You know, people are freaked out because values are diving, everyone's uncertain. The same thing is happening, of course, to the employment market. So you've got state governments, I think, now that are extremely attuned to the incipient failure of those two taxes that they've really, really heavily, if slightly shamefacedly, relied upon. So, you know, people are, I guess that the stakeholders are driven to the table by a sense of crisis and need for reform, and that's a really powerful driver, I think, in politics. Mind you, there's no such thing as the ideal time to do something crazy on tax. I mean, like, you know, I remember when John Howard announced in 1996, as he was going into this campaign, you know, bleeding from a million bullet holes, you know, he'd done some quite remarkable things that had got him into trouble with various constituents, like gun reform and stuff. And, I mean, he announced quite late in the piece.
So this is 98, right?
Yeah, in 98, that he was, so post-96, when he was going into the 98 election, which is an early election, obviously, he sort of said to his colleagues, oh, by the way, I'm going to be campaigning on introducing a GST. And, of course, you know, his words that Australia would never, ever have a GST were still ringing in the electorate's ears. I mean, he did the honourable thing, took it to an election, you know, if you hate it that much, then vote me out. And they nearly did. But I mean,
Chris Bowen said it exactly.
Well, anyway, he did, Yeah, it was very horrifying for some of his colleagues at the time when he decided to do that, but he got there in the end.
And in fact, as Peter Costello points out, they really won two elections defending the GST because it was introduced 20 years ago. Mm. That's right, the 2001 election, Labor pledged to roll it back. So the government had just introduced it. It had only been up and running for whatever it was, 18 months or 12 months, I think, a bit over that.
Yep.
And they had to defend it all over again and won that 2001 election, the so-called Tampa election, of course, the one that also had September 11 just before it. It was all kinds of turbulence around that.
Yeah, and there were controversies with the implementation of the GST too. God, I remember writing 500 million stories about, you know, what would happen to a can of Coke and what would happen to a barbecue chicken as opposed to a frozen chicken. It's just like...
And it set a whole new tradition in political reporting. I mean, in the end, a few elections later, we were talking about the $100 roast, as Barnaby Joyce was saying about the carbon pollution reduction scheme, I think.
Yep. I don't think that ever happened either.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think now about where he is? I mean, this is where the government is now in terms of job seeker and job keeper. The plan is to end these things in September.
Yeah.
All the talk is that the economy is in worse shape and facing a longer, steeper recession than perhaps was hoped for at the beginning.
Right.
What are the political risks for him?
We haven't heard the term snapback for a while, have we?
No, we haven't.
And that was... I guess, you know, I mean, this is a crisis with few precedents, right? So because it's not it's not a kind of proper recession, i.e. caused by economic factors, it's sort of recession caused by this meteor slamming into the economy that was the, you know, result of someone eating a bat sandwich, you know, in Wuhan. So, I mean, it's very weird, and I guess that, running into the shutdown, the feeling that we were taking control, that we were deciding to shut down the economy so as to protect ourselves from the horrific scenes that we'd seen in emergency departments in Italy and so on, I guess it was natural to assume at that point, okay, we're in control so we can just shut it off again and bring things back to life. And there was this sort of talk of hibernating businesses and so on. Now, obviously, for all sorts of reasons, not least being that our commerce with other countries is just grievously affected by all of this in an ongoing way, that idea of sort of waking up businesses is not going to be as easy as all that, right? Like, so there's a really complicated question about the nature and advisability of ongoing government support. And of course, you've got, many, many Australians who have been relying on job keeper and job seeker who will be in a very bad way indeed if that's all just evaporated in September, as was the initial plan. So, look, there's some huge decisions to be made, and I think that they will hugely affect the government's standing, which is really, you know, rock solid at the moment because they've dealt pretty well with a shocking situation. And if you want a comparison, I mean, just look at the US. I mean, that is a system that has responded badly. All of the flaws, the underlying flaws in that country's health system and political system have been opened up, exposing cankers of race relations and all sorts of questions that usually sort of thrum along below the surface of American culture, I think. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a much better story here, and I think it'd be a rare person who hasn't over the last few months just quietly given thanks for our political system, our electoral system, and our general capacity to respond well to threats.
Yes, it only took 120 years for the Commonwealth, for the Federation to actually finally kind of, you know, get into work. Synchronicity. Yeah. It was really quite remarkable. But, of course, you know, there have been mistakes along the way as well, and one of more celebrated one was Scott Morrison's announcement on the 13th of March, I think it was, pretty much the same time as he was setting up the National Cabinet. He announced that there was going to be this prohibition on groups of greater than 500 people.
That was going to switch
in from Monday, but on Saturday he was going to go to the footy and he was advocating that other people do as well. Now, it's not a huge thing, but the sort of mixed message of that I think was pretty extraordinary. Australia's got away with a few things that have gone wrong, relatively lightly, even the Ruby Princess not closing the borders to the United States when they were really the major source of incoming infections for a while, things like that.
I agree with you. I think that football thing was really interesting, actually. And I thought it was a definite re-emergence of that old Scott Morrison, the one who grabs the woman's hand and, you know, forces her into a handshake in this sort of bushfire plagued area. There is a thread of stubbornness in the Prime Minister, just personally, I think. And I'm sure it was fired in the years when he was Immigration Minister and he became very, very defiant in the face of attacks on his immigration policies and that whole on water issue and the absurd, you know, refusal to hand over detail about what was happening with boats and so on. It happens to lots of politicians that serve in those really difficult portfolios where you get attacked a lot. You develop almost this sort of perverse joy in just refusing to back down. I mean, you see it in Peter Dutton as well, I think.
You do. It's like you see in press conferences, they behave almost like the object is to give over no information and to sort of – it's like a verbal game of tennis.
But, I mean, John Howard was like that too. I mean, God, I remember I don't know how many hundred press conferences where we'd play this sort of semantic game about the definition of the word sorry and why he wouldn't sort of, the national apology was something that he would not do because he gave us sort of lectures on exactly what, you know, repentance and what's the word sorry meant. Anyway.
I wonder if he's sorry about that now. He probably wouldn't say.
Well, possibly. I mean, but, you know, it's really hard to be in a public position for a long period of time and not get defensive about your past, you know, statements and what you've said. And Scott Morrison wanted to stick to his guns with the footy, and I'm going to go to the footy because going to the footy is great. And, you know, and as those few days kind of rolled by, this idea that he was still going to show up to the footy started becoming, you know, ludicrous, because remember the world was changing very quickly at that point, and yet he kind of stuck by it for as long as he could. And I just thought, oh, that's a real throwback to the bushfire era Morrison. I think
I think to be fair, Albanese was going to go to the footy as well briefly there and then decided not to. So it was everyone was on a bit of a learning curve in terms of the overall gravity of the situation. But I do think there's been, you know, some recognition of that, some moderating. You've even seen it, I think, in him being more polite in a number of those press conferences, some of which weren't going all that well for him those Monday night press conferences and so forth. You could sort of see a growing awareness that he was in a conversation through these journalists with the people of Australia, and that being super punchy all the time is can turn people off.
Yeah, certainly that the demeanour did change. I agree with you. And I think, well, for instance, I mean, I thought it was interesting when a week or two ago he made the statements on radio about Australia not having had slavery, and then he capitulated and apologised. And I guess in another age he might have fought that through, but fought it through to its conclusion. But I think he thought it through with the TH and just thought, do you know what? It's not worth dying on that hill. I think when you've got a bunch of real issues to worry about, your capacity to spend endless amounts of time on sophistry and the pursuit of culture war issues, I think, should become less important. And I think probably
it should do. Now, on that culture wars thing, I mean, consistency is important. And what do you think about the inconsistency of, on the one hand, shoveling billions of dollars into the economy to protect jobs in companies that are privately run and everything else, and then in respect of your own employees, people that over whom you do have direct responsibility, maintaining pre-recession austerity programs, or as they call them euphemistically, the efficiency dividend. Now, this goes obviously to the ABC, but it also goes to National Gallery of Australia, a whole lot of universities, a whole lot of cultural institutions. And, you know, there does feel like there's a culture war aspect or an ideological aspect to this. What do you think?
I mean, as you say, those decisions predate the COVID-19 crisis. They affect organisations more broadly that the government doesn't view as supportive. I think, you know, that's just to put it baldly. I think there's been, particularly vis-a-vis the university sector, there's been just a really robustly and unnecessarily hard line that's been taken by the government throughout the COVID crisis. I mean, even redrawing the JobKeeper proposition, seemingly, you know, with the effect of excluding universities. I think it's short-sighted, and that's just an opinion, I guess. I think that, you know, I mean, it's – education is such a big part of our export product in this country.
Yeah, it's short-sighted, but it's also economically a little bit incomplete. I mean, as a sort of a policy suite, you're taking the third largest export, a sector that directly employs 120 or more thousand workers, and you're sort of saying, you know, you're on your own, sunshine, and that means a number of jobs are shared and a lot of capacity is shared, and that sector is underperforming, and that is at a time when you want your major sectors of your economy to survive. So irrespective of whether you like them or not, you know, just seemed to me to be a little bit churlish.
Right. And, you know, by the same token, I guess you saw this sort of lengthy process in which the government kind of considered an aid package for the arts industry, which is, you know, incredibly hard hit, one of the earliest of the hard hit, and full of people who, for structural and sort of cyclical reasons, couldn't get JobKeeper either. I mean, I've made a point several times of noting that we were really, really quick out of the gates with $100 million for zoos so that animals wouldn't go starving, but, you know, nothing for jugglers. So, yeah, that was a bit weird. And, you know, eventually they've come up with $250 million package, which is not inconsiderable. So that's like a really welcome move. But even in the announcement of it, you can see the Prime Minister absolutely emphasising that this is really for the roadies and the tradies and not for the lovies, which is, you know, hey, a buck's a buck. So really, I'm sure that that package will benefit many people in the industry. But yeah, it is indicative of, like, that is where the sort of ideological fault line still lies, you know, targeting arts and humanities students in the road ahead, which is going to, I think, throw up all sorts of strange unintended consequences. But I mean, you know, the tertiary sector has just been slogging along with all sorts of decisions and reversals and indecisions for a really long time. I mean, it's a sector that has been bedeviled by serial new education ministers with new proposals that end up not going anywhere and so on. So it's really hard to flourish in that environment. And I think, given that if there is a hope in terms of our energy troubles, that the government sort of hanging its hat on technology as a solution, you think, well, it'd be good to have a really great working tertiary sector, because that's where a lot of this brain work is going to come from.
Indeed it is. Now, we're getting very close to time, unfortunately, but there's a couple of things I might very quickly go to with.
Yeah.
One of them is China. I'm interested in what your thoughts are about how the Prime Minister has – even during this, chosen this time to kind of ratchet up some of the pressure on China. And in the announcement of this step up in investment of defensive capability, buying missiles and hardware and so forth, he's really vindicated in a way. You remember Andrew Hastie's somewhat inflammatory comments likening the rise of China to the rise of Nazi Germany in the 30s. Well, the Prime Minister has not exactly repeated that, but he said words to the effect, we have not seen the conflation now being experienced in Australia of strategic, economic and political challenges since the existential threat faced in the 1930s and 40s. It does appear to be very much the sort of logic that Hastie was trying to put forward and for which he, you know, received quite a lot of criticism.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, diplomatic language, we're used to it being very pasty and unremarkable, but, I mean, when you hear a prime minister use the terms existential threat and also, as you said today, we won't surrender, I mean, there's a huge amount of, you know, evocative of conflict language going on here. And look, they've been, I think, they've tried, I think, diplomatically to tread this line between the US and China. They've tried to deal with all the obvious signs from China that there's big trouble going on, like a complete freeze out of normal diplomatic channels and these ad hoc decisions, you know, like on Bali, for instance, that hugely disadvantage Australian producers. There's a limit to how many times you can say, well, I'm sure this is nothing, you know, significant. It's just a sort of, you know, a subject-specific event. You know, you've got to at some point acknowledge that there is a kind of a power shift going on here. And I think, I mean, I was, I'm sure, not the only person who was a tiny bit puzzled last week when the Prime Minister hopped up and delivered a press conference about this sort of cyber threat that was, you know, posing a terrible threat to Australian business and government without being absolutely clear about who was talking about it. Was quite clear. But I thought, well, what, you know, what's he actually saying? What's he actually asking people to do? I couldn't quite understand the point of mounting a press conference, but now I can, because like he's kind of preparing the ground for what would be, you know, a significant announcement about investment in the defence of the nation. I mean, $270 billion over a decade is just a giant amount of money. So I guess you've got to prepare the nation for, you know, what might be the rationale behind that deployment.
Yeah. Yeah, no, very, very well put. The other quick thing I just wanted to touch on before we go is the Eden Monaro by-election. Now, of course, we don't know. We don't know this week, of course, who wins that by-election. We know that no government has picked up a seat off an opposition in a by-election federally for 100 years or so.
Yeah.
But there's a whole lot of reasons why.
And the last time it happened, it was during a pandemic. So.
yeah, that's right. There's a whole lot of reasons why this could be the one that breaks it or not. Yeah. But. Would you agree that all the risk is really on Albanese's side? I mean, if the government doesn't pick it up, that's the way by-elections go. But if Labor loses
just,
it?
To be honest, I just think it's really hard to apply all of those orthodoxies to this by-election. I mean, I think under the circumstances, you'd probably expect the government to win it. They've been pretty cautious. You know, they've poured a lot of resources in there. The Prime Minister's spent a lot of time there talking about tradies and getting on people's lawns. But, you know, you don't have that same sort of, we're going to win this. This is about me versus him that you had with, you know, Turnbull before those terrible by-elections in Queensland that sort of began the slide to his ultimate defeat. But I think... it's been interesting to watch the Nats in the last week or two. So, like, I think the headline is you would expect the government to win this by-election. I think most of the polling shows them a bit ahead, and given the circumstances, I think it would be a, you know, surprise if Labor won because of the times, and these are extraordinary circumstances. But like, really interesting, isn't it, to watch the way that the Nats, I mean, they've obviously collapsed into a puddle of cold soup when they were just trying to work out who was going to be pre-selected. You know, there was a terrible scenes with John Barilaro in New South Wales considering whether to contest, and it was shocking with all these blokes sort of scuffling over pre-selection, and then eventually just the women who had contested it in the past stepped up and were available. But interesting to see what the Nats have been saying about ABC funding in the last week or two. I mean, that was a really interesting intervention by John Barilaro on, you know, expressing some concern about the federal government's treatment of the ABC. Now, I mentioned that not because we're all about the ABC and that's the only relevant thing. It's just an interesting development, particularly given how crucial the national broadcaster was in that very electorate of Eden Monaro not very long ago, when people actually literally relied on the ABC to save their lives and those of their families.
Absolutely. Annabel Crabb, thanks so much for being with us on Democracy Sausage. It's been absolutely terrific hearing your thoughts.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here where the sizzle's happening.
And thank you for listening. I'll be back with Democracy Sausage next Monday, Arvo. And until then, as my friend Maria Taflaga would say, wash your hands. She's a doctor, you know.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.